When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
For another special edition of the Michael Deacon program. And of course, I am joined by a very special guest right now. Robert, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing great. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad to know you're from Southern California as well. And Robert, I got to be honest, you know, I don't get too many people from, you know, our parts of the woods out here. So I'm always excited to have a fellow Californian share the air with me.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre. You know, I grew up out here in Los Angeles and have been involved in film and commercials and voiceover and all that stuff ever since I was 15 years old. And it seems like everybody out here is from somewhere else.
That's true.
Everyone's shocked when you say, yeah, I grew up here. And then every once in a while, you'll be in a room where everybody is from there. Everybody's from California, and we're all kind of surprised at that.
Yeah.
But I think it's not a dig. Maybe it is a little bit of a dig. I think the reason Californians get somewhat of a bad name is from the people that didn't grow up
that here, are not from here,
that moved here. Because the people that grew up here, I mean, we're all pretty chill.
And we love it.
It's like, eh, whatever. You know, we're used to traffic. We grew up driving in the car in traffic, so it doesn't throw us. And, you know, we just kind of get on with the day.
That's very true. Very accurate statement there. And yeah, lots of people not from here like to criticize those who are from here. And of course, those people that do criticize have never been out here to begin with. Unfortunately, that's the funny thing about it all. But I got to be honest, I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. California I think it's the alpha and the omega.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I love it. You know, the weather is, of course, is outstanding.
It's amazing, yeah.
And I love that it's low humidity. And, you know, growing up out here, it's a different experience. I think it's hard for people to move from the East Coast
out here to the West,
to Los Angeles, especially from a major metropolitan city like New York to L.A. And the major problem they have is just you have to drive. You know, you go from a culture where you can walk a lot, you see people on the street, you take subways or cabs or whatever. I mean, that's how you get around, to all of a sudden you have to have your own car.
Because
Los Angeles is pretty spread out.
Very spread out.
When we talk about distances, people say, well, how far away is blah, blah, blah? We never say miles. What do we say?
Oh, you know.
We say time.
That's right. How much? Well, usually 2 hours.
Yeah. How long is it? You know, how long is it? How far away is that? Oh, it's about 30 minutes. That could be that it's two blocks away, or it could be 30 miles away, depending on the
traffic.
The traffic. Yeah, exactly. I have a friend of mine, an actor. The 405 is everyone's nightmare, the freeway, the San Diego freeway. And he, I don't know how he got this license plate through the DMV, but the license plate is FN405. So it's the FN405.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Pretty creative.
Yeah.
But yes, California, I know lots of people like to disparage us out here, but, you know, lots of things are good out here. It's not like San Francisco everywhere. And no dig at them, but
San Francisco is beautiful, man.
Yeah, it's beautiful there. Yeah,
I love going up to San Francisco. I don't understand why San Francisco people up there don't like Los Angeles people, because I love San Francisco and San Francisco people. I think it's just basically the sports teams are battling one another.
That too, but of course it depends where you are out there as well. You know, there's some bad parts out there, like there are here.
That's the truth.
I guess it just depends, you know, what you're into and, you know, what you have to see that day, in other words, you know.
Well, it's all about, I think Los Angeles, it's all about insulation. You want to be in your house, you want to be separated from everybody. When you get into your car, you want to be insulated. You want,
true.
So you kind of, the only time you're ever exposed is from your house to your car, and then from your car to wherever you're going.
Right.
And isn't it weird sometimes? You'll actually see somebody else driving in a car that you know.
Yeah, that
and then it's like a shock.
It really is.
Oh my God, that's Jerry. Jerry, hey.
Yeah, it's a big zoo out here. So this should be fun. I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, actually, you know, I meant to do this sooner. I actually had, I think it was back in, I want to say 2016 at AlienCon.
Ah, yeah, of course.
I was there at the dinner.
Really?
I was there and I saw you out there. I was going to approach you and ask you to be on the show, but I don't exactly know what happened, but I had to leave shortly after.
Was this one in Santa Clara?
In Santa Clara, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that was...
That was fun, right?
That was really an epic AlienCon.
That was great.
The very first time we ever did it. We had no idea what to expect, and... that's why it was done in conjunction with, I guess, Famous Monsters magazine. Mm-hmm. And they all thought, well, at least we'll get some of the monster crowd and maybe a few people from Aliens would show up. And it turned out to be insane.
It was so much fun.
Oh, my goodness.
I had a great time, yeah. I even saw the band.
That dinner was great. That was when Kevin asked the audience how many people had, seen a UFO or had an experience or a close encounter, when basically three quarters of the people raised their hands, we were all amazed. Amazed.
Yeah, I remember that.
And Giorgio was totally unprepared for it. He was like a rock star.
He was
not expecting that.
Yeah, he got a great standing ovation.
Yeah, they didn't have, along with his hair.
That's right. And so did you, though.
We had no idea how many people were really huge fans of the show. So it was humbling in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And the final, were you there for the final big, I guess, super panel?
Yeah, I was there. The big panel, the big tables and the big room there past that little water park.
They had to move that. It was supposed to be at a much smaller venue, but they realized we can't fit everybody in.
It was crazy.
I have a photograph I took from up on stage of the basically standing room only, and it was also funny on a personal note, because you know they told me, okay, you're going to introduce everybody, okay, sure, and, you know, I knew people, but I hadn't really met them yet until
that first
time, so I had to write everything down. And of course, I was sitting on the end of the table, and somebody came up to me, one of the organizers, and said, okay, you're going to have to wrap this up or, you know, get to the conclusion because you're getting close to the hour. And I thought, me? When did it suddenly become my job?
I know. Now they throw it at you.
But it was a great amount of fun, man. That was incredible.
Yeah, that was awesome. I had a wonderful time out there as well. And yeah, I'm glad you remembered that one.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. We still talk about it because it was just so unexpected, and the energy was just so electric there. And there were other events that were happening. There was even, I think, an Armenian wedding that was happening. It was all kinds of crazy stuff was happening at that hotel. And people were crying because they couldn't get into some of the rooms where people were talking.
Oh, I didn't know that part.
We had no idea. We thought, okay, well, you know, a room for 100, that should be fine. And then all of a sudden, 500 people show up. So it was
pretty surreal,
pretty amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that was the first time I met George Nori.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. He invited me to be on the show.
Uh huh.
just, you know, to plug this show, and that's when this show is kind of barely kicking up some steam.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been in and out of the radio thing for a while. I was actually producing a show for the late John McAfee.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. Very different. But, you know, wow. all remote. They're out there in Texas. Well, I don't even know where he was, but it was like a small radio station out in Texas.
About the virus guy, right?
Yeah, that guy.
Mm-hmm.
The tax invasion guy.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that was something else. But that was many moons ago. But nowadays, you know, doing the whole freelance voiceover thing, that's been mm-hmm. Hit or miss. You know, I've done some commercials for the radio, but, you know, they're all very small projects.
Yeah.
It's so shattering.
It's soul shattering. Yeah.
Sometimes it can be.
It'll crush you.
Yes. I get rejected more than I get hired, in other words.
Well, that's par for the course.
That's right.
That's
part of the game.
You know, everybody has that. You have to have a thick skin when it comes to. I have a friend of mine who is a voice actor. He's also a writer, director, does all kinds of things. But he said he couldn't handle. He could handle the rejection as an actor.
Yeah,
that was okay. But handling the rejection as a writer was much more difficult. So I guess you have to, in entertainment, pick your area of rejection that you can handle.
That's how I feel. You know, I was, you know, I have some mild success with doing like a small independent show, but doing trying to get some proper representation through an agent, that's something else. You know, being rejected by that hits me a lot harder.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's difficult. I wish I had advice on how to get that goal or accomplish that goal. But I really don't, because it's the business is so arbitrary
right.
at times.
No, I agree.
It's I think that in voiceover, talent does win out only because you can't hide behind how you look.
Right.
I mean, I've done on camera commercials and TV shows and all kinds of stuff, and oftentimes they'll hire you just because you look a certain way. You know, that this is what we're going for. And everybody there is kind of a decent actor. And so they just hire you for that.
Sure.
But in voiceover, just having a great voice is not enough.
It's not.
And a lot of people think that, well, just because, you know, people tell me I have a nice voice, I should be working. Well, that's not the case. And, you know, most of the people that I know that are really successful in voiceover, excuse me, have had they've had a lot of training. They've got amazing backlog of experience. I remember I was working on this one movie. It's called XXX or something. It was Xander.
Oh yeah,
yeah, one of those movies.
I remember
Xander, whatever the heck it is. And we were just doing ADR. We were just doing background voices. They brought us in to do, okay, you know, there's a motorcycle chase. This guy gets shot. We need a sound of him, like, falling off the motorcycle. Or here's somebody else getting kicked. Give me a grunt. You know, that kind of stuff. It was all just that kind of stuff.
Yes.
The whole day. Nothing that was really too taxing. But I met this one fellow that was there. And he was a Filipino actor. And he was nominated for an Olivier Award because he played the lead character in Miss Saigon, and he was about to go back to Broadway to redo the revival of Miss Saigon on Broadway as the lead character. And here I'm looking at this thing, and wait a minute, this guy's nominated for an Olivier Award. That's the English equivalent of the Tony. Right.
Right.
This guy is super, super talented, accomplished. This guy has got a lot of experience. And here he is, just like me, going, because it's a paycheck. So
absolutely. Yeah.
The people that are working generally have studied a lot. And that's one thing that a lot of voiceover people don't, newbies that are coming in, don't understand, that you really have to have your acting chops. They're really strong because you're competing against people.
Lot of people.
Oh, yeah. I have friends that are, you know, graduates of the Yale School of Drama. They've got master's degrees. They've had extensive
vocal training,
stage career,
and voice acting. They got it all. Yeah.
And what they're looking for now, they always want, they just want you. They just want this natural person. But to access you is difficult for a lot of people. A lot of actors don't know how to play anymore. Just have a good time. And it's kind of shocking. You know, when I was teaching, I would tell the students, I'd say, listen, don't worry about embarrassing yourself. I will out embarrass any of you. Okay. So just have a good time. Let's explore. Let's kind of push the boundaries. Let's see who you are, what you're made of, what you got inside. You got to just be able to, you know, rip open your chest and let it all out, both warts and all. But a lot of them just don't have that muscle. I don't know if they just spend too much time staring at a video screen and not enough time on by themselves just trying to figure out what to do.
That you know out here. And for those that don't know, Robert, of course, is a narrator for the History Channel. And of course, you've seen him on Ancient Aliens and The Curse of Oak Island. Of course, you were in that video game, StarCraft.
Oh, yes, that little game that
took off.
Did moderately well.
Yeah, that little game. And of course, I'm sure people...
Jim Rayner and StarCraft. Yeah, that was quite an experience.
You know, many, many moons ago, I did hear your voice back in that game. And once I heard you much later on in life, I thought, man, that guy sounds familiar. And of course, there you were on Ancient Aliens.
It was quite a trip. I mean, I was there at the very beginning. This was 1997. I'm trying to remember when I first met Chris Metzen, who was the creator of StarCraft. And at that time, you know, Blizzard was just, you know, they weren't Blizzard the way they are now. And I remember sitting with Chris, and he was showing me some of the sketches that he did of Jim Rayner, of StarCraft, of the, you know, the universe, the world that was going to be StarCraft. And they were just like in a sketchbook. Now those same sketches are protected like the Mona Lisa.
Yeah.
You go to Blizzard and they're in climate controlled room behind, you know, 2 inches of glass. But it's amazing how that whole
a project comes to life.
Yeah, and how it evolved and how many people were affected by it. When we did the first one, you know, to be honest with you, I don't even remember it that well, because it was just a job that I did and you knocked it out and then, you know, it takes forever for the thing to come out. And I remember many years later, I was working on a soap opera. It was Young and the Restless. I used to play the judge on the Young and the Restless.
Oh, no kidding. You
know, did like 100 episodes or something. Oh, wow. Yeah. I was known as the mean judge.
Ah, the mean judge.
And I remember I was on the set and a couple of the grips or people that were working on the show were talking about this video game. They're talking about StarCraft. And I said, oh, you're talking about StarCraft? And I said, yeah. I said, well, I'm in that. I said, really? What do you play? I said, well, I think his name's Jim. I couldn't even remember the last name. Jim Rockford? Jim. They said, Rayner? I said, yeah. And their jaws like dropped to the floor.
Oh, I bet.
You're Jim Rayner? Yeah. And after that, I realized, you know, maybe I missed something here. I should kind of check out, see what this whole StarCraft thing is that's going on. And then when I, you know, Googled it, all of a sudden realized, oh my God, this thing is taken off.
Yeah.
This is a huge sensation around the entire world. It was amazing. So that's why when the second iteration of the game came out, StarCraft II, I desperately wanted to be involved and do Jim Rayner again, because I felt I'd missed that experience, and I wanted to have the experience of being in this game and doing this and seeing what was happening in the world with and how people were reacting to it. And fortunately, I did.
That's pretty awesome. You had no idea how it would take off and affect the gaming world, in other words. And
it influenced so many. It went where Chris Metzen and I were sitting looking at these sketches to where Jim Rayner, the character that I portrayed, is on the side of a Korean Airlines 747. Not just a little picture. I mean, he's taken up basically half the plane, and it's flying around the world. It's, you know, to think, whoa, that we're there? Amazing. And the characters were so rich. The writing was so fantastic. The director was amazing. Worked with Andrea Romano, one of the best animation directors on the planet. And it was just a marvelous, marvelous experience. And it was so meaningful and impactful to so many people. It really was gratifying on a personal level.
And did you ever play the game yourself at any time?
Yeah, that's the question people ask. If I, you know, first of all, I would say, you know, if I went online and were to play as Jim Rayner, I'm certainly not going to say it's me, because imagine right. the street cred you get if you can tell people you kicked Jim Rayner's ass in StarCraft. And when I got the first game, yeah, I played it, but I'm impatient.
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah,
yeah, and I get frustrated with those games. So they told me all the cheat codes, all the things that could give you, like, you know, unlimited strength, so that you could never die.
Nice.
So you could just power through the game, and I did do that. But I've been to quite a few conventions, tournaments, and I've met a lot of the professional players. And if you've never gone to see these pros play this game in front of a big crowd, you really need to.
That is what surprises me the most, by the way, and not to interrupt you, but the fact that there's so many damn people there to watch people playing video games, it's kind of mind-boggling.
Well, it's really exciting, and the casters, you know, they're not sportscasters, they're just casters.
Yeah.
These are the guys that are men and women that go up and they describe what's happening with the game, and they're phenomenal.
Yeah, they're
always wearing like a jacket and tie. You know, they're dressing up for it.
It's taken very seriously, in other words.
Yeah, and I know that in Korea, when they set some crazy records where, you know, like 100,000 people would show up in a stadium to watch two guys play this game. I mean, it really was the national sport of Korea. I don't know if it still is, but it certainly was that for quite a while. They'd have it aired on television like every night. You'd be watching it. And it really is exciting. People have the thunder sticks and they're screaming. And when the pros play, each game doesn't really last that long. It's not like, you know, you're watching it for 3 hours
right.
when you're doing one game. You know, it could be 15, 20 minutes. And then all of a sudden, it's like a chess move. They realize, hey, I've lost. And they just basically resign at that point. And all the casters know when it's over. So it's exciting.
For sure. I'm just always surprised that so many people are into that. But of course, if you go to, you know, popular websites like Twitch and all that, you see that there are major audiences watching this live in real time, mm-hmm. very much invested into it. And that's always good, in my opinion.
It's I read some stats somewhere. I'm trying to remember where it was that, you know, more people either tune in and watch these things than are watching like the Super Bowl. But sports center type shows, they don't really realize what kind of an event this is. I don't think they really understand.
They don't get
this
it.
Is
yeah.
a competition.
Yeah.
And it
right.
is a sport. And, you know, these people that play it, the top pros, I mean, they don't have a long shelf life, because you have to have this incredible eye-hand coordination to play these games and also be able to think strategically. It is like playing chess, but it's chess on, you know, some crazy steroids or something. It's just so complex and so moving. But once you start understanding what's going on, then you can really appreciate the subtlety that's associated with it and the different strategies that these players have. And they really are athletes.
Right. And of course, you can die while playing these games too. Well, any video game, as you've seen on the news, which is insane. You see them playing in these coffee shops or internet shops, whatever you want to call them. And, you know, they're having seizures and stuff because they've been playing for hours and not eating.
Yeah, they don't eat. They don't go to they go to the bathroom. They
That's
do
wild.
It right in the seat there. It's like, oh my goodness. Okay. All right.
You got to be really into it. I mean, I love video games, don't get me wrong, but to be playing for hours, that's...
Yeah, when whoa. I need to go, I go. I don't care what's going
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
that takes precedence.
It's a whole different animal right there. Much respect to them, though. And, of course, you are also known for your incredible talents, your narration skills on Ancient Aliens.
Yeah, Ancient Aliens, which, goodness, we've done... I think like 230 episodes.
That's insane.
Some crazy number like that. We keep going.
That's what that's another thing I always have to mention it to anyone who's been on the show. And I have plenty of people that have been on the show that, of course, have been appearing on Ancient Aliens for a while. And I always ask them, are you surprised that the series has gone on for this long? And not in a negative way, just in the fact that This thing has taken off.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'll go back to Kevin Burns, who was the late great Kevin Burns, who was the fellow that created Ancient Aliens, created Curse of Oak Island. He was a brilliant, brilliant man. He was a professor who taught film at, I think it was Boston University. So he understood filmmaking. He understood what people liked about films, but he was also a kid at heart, where he had like the world's largest collection of Munster memorabilia. I mean, he collected all kinds of crazy stuff.
Oh, wow.
But he, he told a great story about, and I'm sure he told it at that first convention that you were at, about how Ancient Aliens evolved. And it started out as just a 2-hour episode about, I guess, the moon. That was it. And History Channel put it on, and no matter what hour they put it on, it found an audience. And so the History Channel came back to him and said, listen, can you do 3 more shows? He goes, okay. And he did 3 more episodes. And in his opinion, they still tried to kind of bury it a little bit, tried to kill it. They would put it on at, 3 in the morning or whatever. And people still found it. People were still drawn to it. So they kept on adding more episodes. And at one point, he goes, guys, I've run out of pyramids. how many stories about, I've run out of pyramids. I don't have any more material. And they said, well, are you not going to do it? He says, of course I'm going to do it, but I'm just telling you. So it evolved from where it was kind of challenging to find the different subjects that we were looking for on the show to now. I mean, as we're speaking, there's a congressional hearing about UFOs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, come on. There's all these crazy Tic Tac videos, the evidence that's coming out. It's now we pick and choose. We're inundated with topics, and we have to kind of filter through it a little bit to find which ones we want to do that are interesting. Everything is constantly changing too. If we'd done a show, we did several about Close Encounters 10 years ago. There's a huge volume of material since then that now we can tap into. And I think Kevin was also a genius when it came to casting. The way that he found these people, I mean, Giorgio was hired, I guess, originally on a documentary that I actually narrated for Kevin about Indiana Jones.
Ah,
and they brought him on as an expert about that. And when he was doing Ancient Aliens, Kevin was thinking, okay, who do I want in this? We need to have, he figured out how to, how to tap into what people were interested in and find people that were not only intelligent, interesting, charismatic, A personalities. So all the theorists that you see up there, not only are they experts in their field and incredibly charismatic, well, they're able to speak, and everybody gets along as well. Even though they have divergent opinions quite often about things, they still get along quite well. Kevin just had this magic of putting all these people together in a room, and it just worked.
It worked, yeah.
Yeah. And he also understood, people would say, why do you not have a skeptic on the show? And he would explain, he'd say, listen, if I was doing a show about the Nativity, why would I bring on an atheist? What is that going to add to the story? Guy's just going to piss on everything I'm saying. That's not that doesn't help move the ball forward. There's always skeptics out there. So in our show, we don't tell you what it is that you need to believe this. We just share the evidence. We say this is what legends tell us. This is what the hieroglyphics, on the pyramid tell us. If you think there's something else, then maybe you're right. But these are, it's not that we're telling you. This is what our ancestors have been saying.
Yeah, it's a great show.
They don't even know how old the Sphinx is. the Egyptians have no written record of ever creating it. It's like they found it, buried in the sand. How did it get there? Who built it? Why? And here's something that's crazy. Here's something that's wild. I did an episode earlier this year where it was about the Great Pyramid of Giza, and when I read this in the script, I couldn't believe it. But the coordinates, the longitude and latitude of the Great Pyramid of Giza, is the speed of light in meters per second.
Oh, wow. That I didn't know.
How is that? That's can't pretty... be just an accident.
No.
And if it's built, you know, 2,500 years ago or whenever it was built, the concept of the speed of light?
Yeah, that makes no sense.
What? Come on.
But a lot of things from, you know, ancient times make you scratch your head and wonder how these primitive men or and women were able to accomplish all these things that, you know, we still have trouble doing today.
You know, Giorgio has told me, I think it's Machu Picchu. I mean, I'm trying to remember exactly where it is, that the way the stones are cut, you can't even fit a piece of paper between them. There's no way we could even do it with that kind of precision now.
Right.
And they did it then?
Yeah, it makes you wonder. And that's what I like about the show.
Well, here's one thing that I was thinking, and I just overheard a conversation. This was actually at an alien con. It's really interesting to be in the green room because I'm not a theorist. I'm not an expert on any of this stuff. But to sit at a table and you hear Linda Moulton Howe talking to David Childress, who's talking to Dr. Travis Taylor, and they're all just talking about stuff. And, you know, the Earth is – how old is the Earth? It's like, a billion years old or some crazy number like that. Who's to say that there haven't been this constant, you know, evolution and then – dying out of different species, even humans, over those billion years. So maybe the knowledge is passed on. And Linda was saying that every, 200,000 or 2 million years, basically what's on the bottom of the sea is now it's now on top. It just – things are kind of churning and turning all the time.
That's right.
And we always find – it's whenever they're digging, they always find something older than what they found before. They've never hit like on – well, that's it.
Yeah,
we've gone as far as we can. That's where it all began.
There's no real answer.
Something that goes a little bit further.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing. You know, it keeps being pushed back every few years. Yeah. How old we really are in our human origins. You know, it's always super interesting to me, and I'm glad to know that you know you are open minded to a lot of these things, and you're not really. I think you're kind of in the middle here. That's kind of what I'm sensing.
Yeah, well, I try to honor the vision of Kevin, and he called himself a skeptic, but open to the information.
Yeah, that's
you know he's
a good
he's
way
not
to
shut
at
down.
And
my job as the narrator is not to preach, it's not to tell you this is the way that it is, to answer all your questions, and I'm also not my job is not to be a critic and just kind of go, this doesn't make any sense, this is BS. I just basically draw you in. And I ask the questions. That's one of the wonderful things about the show is we just ask the questions. Here's the information. Is it possible? That's why those key questions that Kevin wrote, you know, the is it possible? Could it be? What if it were true? I guess they just kind of strike a chord in all of us. In fact, you go to these conventions, people have T-shirts that say, could it be?
Could it be? Right.
Or ancient astronaut theorists say yes. And it's... I have to. I take a little bit of credit there.
Yeah, you
Kevin,
have to.
Kevin wrote the lines, but
that's got to make you smile, though, to see that.
Yeah, I made them my own. I have a. I really enjoy that aspect of it and saying those words. And whenever I'm saying them in a script, I'm kind of giving a wink to everybody that's watching because they're kind of looking forward to it. I remember at that very first convention when I came out and. Everybody wanted to hear me say, ancient astronaut theorists
they
say yes.
Yes.
They were like hanging on it. And, you know, since I'm a little bit of a ham, I said, listen, I'm going to say it. Don't worry. But I'm going to tease you a little bit. We're going to be dancing. We have a cocktail. Don't worry. You'll get it in the end.
Well, for those that weren't there, you got the biggest pop or biggest... ovation of everybody. You know, everybody was cheering right as they announced your name.
Oh, it was so sweet and so unexpected. And I'm a pretty humble guy, and I really try to live in the present, and I certainly have no expectations. So it was a real sweet surprise, and you could feel the love from the people. It was you know, not a challenging audience, in that they were there to support you and love you and listen to what you had to say. And so it was, I had fun. I had a lot of fun with them. And I think they pick up on that.
Oh, yes. They see that you are genuine and you enjoyed this. And, you know, you could feel that sort of energy in the room. And it's good to get that kind of ovation, especially when you are just, you know, you're just a narrator, which was awesome. It's like a rock star came out. It was incredible.
it's kind of surprising. But, you know, it's I get a lot of emails or messages from people who watch the show, and they let me know that my narration is a big part of the show for them.
It is.
A lot of them.
No, it is. It is.
They have it on. It's just, I don't want to say 24/7, but, you know, on marathon days, they'll just have it on in the background while they're doing things. A lot of people tell me, especially women, that they'll listen to my voice or listen to the show at night, listen to my voice, and they'll fall asleep.
Yeah,
they always say, but in a good way.
Yes.
And I say, well, that's good.
In a comforting way.
Yeah, I'm not there to scare you. I'm there to kind of take you on the journey. I have, in voiceover, we have what we call vocal signatures. If somebody were to describe you, they would say, oh, he's intense. He's angry. Well, you know, whatever it might be. You know, if you were to describe the comic Lewis Black, he's bitter, he's angry, he's opinionated, which is all good. It's all fine. That's why we pay attention to him. But the vocal signature that I was given that I think really hit the nail on the head was that I was described as approachable intelligence.
Oh.
Now that doesn't mean that I'm smart. It just means that when I'm saying something that sounds like it's smart, it's not like it's intimidating. I'm inviting you in. I'm sharing it with you. So I'm bringing you on the journey. And when I go and I do that, the show, I'm on the journey with you. I don't get the script in advance. I don't rehearse it. They just hand it to me that morning, and we open it up to page one, and I'll read it to myself just so I know what's on that. I'll say it out loud just to make sure I got all the pronunciation right. And then we do it. So if there's something in there, like, for example, that piece of information about the Great Pyramid of Giza that I talked about earlier.
Right.
I find that to be really interesting, really fascinating. So it allows, by not rehearsing like that, allows my own natural emotion or reaction to the material come out. And I think that kind of translates into the way that I do the script and what people resonate with when they listen to it.
Yeah, you definitely have a different style of narrating that series. You know, it's not a very intimidating sort of style. Like you're just saying, you do have a certain sonic signature to your voice that does sort of, it definitely hits that sort of mark in your brain where, you know, it's not too intimidating and it's very informative, not too, I guess, not so definitive, in other words.
Yeah. And also, when I'm at conventions, I'll be talking to somebody and they'll say, you sound different when you're doing the show. I say, well, come here. And I get real close to the microphone because that's the distance from the mic to my mouth. And that's basically where their ear would be. And I would say, ancient astronaut theorists say yes. it's because I'm talking to them right at that point. And then they go, oh, yeah.
That's you.
You're the guy. So it's a part of it is just the placement. And in my mind, where that person is when I'm talking to them and what level I need to talk to them. Them at volume wise.
Right. Mic placement and just the way you say different things in different phrases. I, of course, have gotten the same thing where people say, you have a fake voice. That guy, he must have a fake voice. And it's like, well, I was only born with one voice.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes I know sometimes I just kind of chop up sentences a little bit. Some of it is just me just trying to catch a breath.
Right.
You know, it's not like this big technique that I've mastered. It's just, this is the way it comes out. And, you know, when you're doing a lot of words in a session, sometimes it's hard to get them all out. And, you know, sometimes we'll chop it up a little bit and I'll go, okay, let's, you know, the director may say, let's kind of say these two or three sentences all as one thing. Okay, all right. Well, I can do that.
Right.
And so I think I've improved over time, which is good. But still, it's it is different. I know that they have another narrator that does the show Ancient Aliens for England, for Europe. I don't know why. In fact, History Channel out here doesn't even know why. But for whatever reason,
that's weird.
You know, maybe the Brits think that if you're going to narrate, you need to sound like David Attenborough or something. Mm. So they've got him doing his thing, but he doesn't put the same kind of spin on it that I do. He doesn't say, "Is it possible? Could it be? What if it were true?" I kind of, part of it is I changed the pace up a little bit.
Sure.
So that people are kind of anticipating that moment. And I say, ancient astronaut theorists say, yes.
Love the pause.
You know I'm going to say it, but you don't know when it's going to be said.
Yes, the pregnant pause is great.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of power in pausing and voiceover.
Absolutely. And, since we're talking about ancient aliens and we just mentioned the whole UFO, the whole debacle, in other words, this is the first time they're saying in over 50 years Congress was holding a public hearing on UFOs.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to know if you are on board yourself with aliens and UFOs, or do you you definitely must believe in this?
Well, I'll tell you what changed for me. Because I don't know. I mean, I haven't had a personal experience.
Nothing personal.
I know that Giorgio has had a personal experience where he's seen what he felt was a UFO. But I haven't had that experience. But I was at a convention in Texas. I guess this was after, the one in Santa Clara. So it was one of those conventions that I was invited to. It wasn't an official alien con. Convention, and it was sparsely attended. I mean, there was nobody there. It was in Dallas, and whatever reason, the promoter really picked the worst weekend to do it, because apparently it was at the end of the summer or the beginning of the summer when school was out, everybody was graduating. But the bottom line is everybody leaves Dallas at that weekend for whatever reason. So there was nobody there, and I was sitting at my table, and this woman comes up to me. And she said, "I'm a friend, big fan of the show, blah, blah, blah." And I said, "Oh, that's great, great." And she goes, "Can I take a picture with you?" "Yeah, absolutely. Can you sign something for me?" "Sure, sure." And since there was nobody there, and finally somebody comes to my table, I say, so how do you find out about the show?" She goes, "Well, I used to work at NASA, and, I worked on, some of the moon programs, the Apollo programs, and, so I'm a big fan of space." Wow. And this and that and the other thing. And as she's walking away, I said, "Excuse me." I said, "Wait a minute. Did anything ever happen while you were at NASA that you've never talked about that you would like to talk about? I mean, anything interesting, weird?" She goes, "It's been the statute of limitations is whatever the statute of limitations is." And she goes, "And it's been over that. So yeah, I can tell you this." And she tells me this story about what happened to her. Her job she was in mission control and was to monitor the vital signs of the astronauts. Right. So she, if you see Apollo 13, you see that room with all the guys in front of the computer screens. She's one of those people. All right. In mission control. So she's monitoring Ron Evans was the pilot of the command module. And this was, I guess it was Apollo 16, 17. It was either the last mission or the next to the last mission where they actually sent up the moon buggy that they were driving around with on the moon.
Ah, yes.
And it was a longer mission. So they spent a longer period of time on the moon. And Ron Evans, who was a former fighter pilot, flew in Vietnam, a guy that is got to be pretty tough, not easily rattled. And he's up in the command module and his job is just orbit the moon while these guys are on the surface. Well, when he goes around the backside of the moon, he's out of radio contact, right? He's on the dark side of the moon. And when he comes back in to radio contact, I guess his job is to say, "I'm here." And then the commander of the mission who was actually on the moon checks in with him. And the guy that's on the moon, I can't remember his name now, says, "Hey, Ron, you lonely up there?" And this astronaut replies, "I'm not alone." And mission control, first of all, this was a live broadcast. Anybody could listen to this. So they immediately switched over to a more secure channel. This woman, friend of mine, who I met that day, she switches over to that private channel. And Mission Control asks Ron Evans, "Ron, are you joking? What's going on?" He says, "No, I'm not joking." He says, "Well, what is it?" He says, I'm being followed. Can you describe it? The command module is apparently about 17 feet from stem to stern. He estimated this thing to be over 40 feet long. He described it when she told me. She says Ron Evans, whenever he would go on a combat mission or into space, his favorite food was Oscar Mayer wieners, right? He would eat hot dogs. And so he described this as, it looked like an Oscar Mayer wiener. And she told me that of the shapes of people that have seen UFOs, either cigar-shaped or a triangle shape, that's the most common shape. So wow. This would have fit into that cigar-shaped category.
Yeah. Interesting.
Ron Evans says, it's not America. This is not Russian. Because I don't know what it is. It followed him in formation for, I think she said, 5 orbits around the moon. And then disappeared.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. That's Apollo 17, I would say.
Okay, Apollo 17. Well, there's more to the story because apparently he took photographs of this thing.
Right, yeah.
When they landed back on Earth and it was a water landing in the ocean, this friend of mine was on the support ship that picked him up out of the ocean. And she saw him sitting in, one of the staterooms there on the Navy ship. And she went up to him and says, "Ron, are you okay?" He was just kind of shaking his head. He goes, I don't know. And she said, "Ron, is this about the anomaly that you saw?" And he says, "You're aware of that?" She goes, "Yeah, I was in the loop. I was part of the conversation." And he told her, he said, "This was something I'd never seen in my life. He goes, I don't know what this was. It's the strangest thing that I've ever experienced." When she told me that story, that this was not somebody telling her the story. This is her experiencing it.
Being there. Yeah.
Being there. Being privy to the conversation. And I would ask her a question. I said, what is NASA's opinion of this? She goes, "Well, we had a meeting that evening after he first described this, where we said, let's not talk about it. And the reason being is because NASA they gather the information. They don't make a decision as to what it is, an evaluation. And they pass it on to, the brain trust. They figure out what the heck it all is. So they said, listen, let's not offer an opinion about this. Let's not talk about it. We'll let the people that understand this kind of stuff or think they understand this stuff, let them figure out what this all means." And I asked her, I said, "What is the opinion of NASA as far as UFOs are concerned?" And she's been to parties where astronauts are all there from different missions are just, having a beer and eating barbecue. And they all have these similar stories of these events that have happened. And Giorgio brought up a really interesting point because he became friends with Neil Armstrong's son. And he talked to him about how his father changed after going to the moon. And you would think, here you are. You go to the moon.
Right.
You go to outer space. That should be like the most exciting, amazing experience of your life. Something you want to talk about forever.
I agree.
Right? I mean, yeah. People would go, "Well, tell us what..." And these people, quite often, these astronauts are changed after this experience. They either saw something or they had some experience there that just altered their perception.
Yeah, they don't come back the same.
Neil Armstrong didn't really want to talk about going to the moon. It was not his son would say, "Yeah, my dad never really talked about it." I would ask him, we wouldn't talk about
it. That's bizarre. Something happened.
Yeah, it's like talking to somebody that was in some horrible combat
trauma.
Mission that they can't talk about. It's just too traumatic.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know it was that severe where it was like even going to a private conversation with someone that you're related to and they are, hesitant to speak about this experience that you would think or you would imagine that it would be positive. It'd be something great to sort of tell and yet they
don't
want
to talk. Maybe it was something that was incredibly humbling. Maybe maybe they experienced something. I don't know. But a lot of them have had similar stories that they'll tell that they saw things that they could not explain that made no sense. And, you look at those Tic Tac videos that are out there now where these Navy pilots, these guys, come on, this is the cream of the crop. These are fighter pilots, right? It's not somebody that's flying a Cessna. These are the top guys. And they're saying this thing is defying the laws of physics.
Yeah, they're blown away.
It's moving too fast. It's turning too quickly. It's how does it do that? You know, is it? You know, I don't think anybody's thinking, oh, yeah, the Chinese have got this phenomenal technology. The Russians have this phenomenal technology. They're just not telling us. I doubt it. I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't find that either.
And remember, with these things, all you have to do is be right once. You know, let's say that 99.9% of all the UFO sightings are worthless. It's swamp gas. It's a weather balloon. It's whatever the heck it is. But let's say there's one.
That's all it takes. Yeah.
That's all it takes.
No, but there's countless of videos from NASA where you see these crazy objects out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure you've seen that.
Yeah. Yeah. I have. And, you know, I've been fortunate to have conversations with some of the theorists about it, and especially Georgia. Georgia's become a really good friend. And,
oh, that's good to hear.
They, you know, they're convinced it's, you know, prove me wrong.
Yeah, I would say a good number of them out there, things that we've seen online, things that have speculated. I'm sure some of those crafts might have been us, but there are those out there, those very few incidents that are, you know, beyond our imagination.
You hear crazy stories. I have a friend of mine, this is now getting to third person, so who knows whether it's accurate or not, but he claims that a friend of his who was a test pilot, not only did he go to Area 51 and see an alien spacecraft, he flew it.
Wow.
His friend flew the thing. Like, what?
Yeah,
really?
That's pretty outrageous.
So, you know, if something did crash, you'd think, of course, they would reverse engineer it.
Sure. Well, that's another one, The Roswell crash after that happened, you know, technology for some reason just blossomed after that period.
Yeah.
So, you know,
you're right.
Who knows, right? Who knows? And another interesting thing that came out recently, not very long in during this month, was the whole alien door on Mars. I'm not sure if you saw that. It was like a...
What's the alien door?
There's this one photograph that was taken by the Curiosity rover, I believe. And it's like this cave opening, and there's like a doorway. And it looks like basically every sort of ancient civilization sort of doorway where it's carved in a very not exactly straight. It definitely doesn't look it doesn't look like it's naturally formed that way. In other words,
it could be, you know, 500 million years old. I mean, we know that Mars used to have water. It was probably a pretty nice place to be.
That's what I'm thinking.
At one point.
And some people believe we've been on Mars.
That is true.
And
you must be talking to Linda and some of the other theorists.
Well, some people say there were child trafficking on Mars at one time by, I think that was Robert David Steele, I believe, set that on the Alex Jones show, and that went crazy for a while. Of course, I don't believe that personally, but some people have a wild imagination, I would say. But
yeah,
I would say perhaps man has been on Mars at one time or another.
I think that we've had, like I said before, that the human race is probably
much older than we
come and
think.
Gone, yeah. And come back and gone and come back. It could have happened, 500 times. I mean, when you think about our own recorded history, was it go back a few thousand years at the most? Going back to the I'll say the Phoenicians, but I talk about them all the time. No, I can't remember.
The Sumerians,
The Sumerians, exactly. And now we find that there's actually civilizations that were older than the Sumerians.
Right.
So who knows? Who knows?
Yeah.
The dinosaurs are here, then they disappear. And they were around for, 100 million years or 50 million years? A heck of a lot longer than we have.
And Michael Cremo, I'm not sure I don't know if you're familiar with Michael Cremo, but he believes that man definitely existed during the time of dinosaurs.
Hey, listen, I love the movie 1 Million Years B.C. when I was
too.
A kid with Raquel Welch, so
yes.
I want to believe that's true.
I want to believe that too, actually. I wish we coexisted with them, for sure. That would be awesome. And Robert, of course, you also had a massive success with Oak Island.
The Curse of Oak Island, yes. It's...
different
it's pretty,
change
pretty
of pace
amazing.
There for you.
I think we just finished our ninth season or our eighth season. I can't remember. right off the top of my head, but it's the number one show on cable Tuesday nights. It's the number one show on History Channel. And we get close to 3 million people tuning in each and every week.
That's crazy.
Amazing.
I love that.
And again, I credit Kevin Burns for creating this.
Another home run.
He found these guys. He was intrigued by the story, and he turned it into this incredibly successful show. And I think a huge factor is the relationship that the two brothers have, Rick and Marty Lagina. You know, it's real. These are two brothers who had this dream when they were kids of exploring for gold. And who hasn't as a kid taken, a metal detector or just gone exploring and tried to find a treasure somewhere? It's everybody dreams of that. Even if you go to the beach and you're just walking around on vacation, you're looking, yeah. maybe there's a diamond down here. Maybe I'll find something really cool, even if it's just a shell or something fascinating. And the guys are so compelling, so interesting, and they're really trying to do it. And they're also smart. They don't need to do this for the fame or the money. They've got plenty of money. This has been something that they've wanted to do, and they look at Rick is a little bit more of the romantic. He's got the real emotional stake in this.
Yeah, you're right.
And Marty, his brother, is a little bit more, he's a little bit more reserved.
More reserved, right.
He's saying, you know what, we can't just spend whatever we want and just go crazy. We got to have a plan here. So we got to control this a little bit, and let's figure out how to do this and do this efficiently and properly. And so you've got all these people that have come together with this goal, and they're all experts, and they're all fascinating, and all interesting, and they're all adding something. And then you add to that the scale that they're doing it at, where you're bringing in these machines. I read these descriptions. It's like a 300-ton machine. I think, what? How big is this thing? And they have to like prepare the ground just because it's so friggin' heavy. And I also think, wait a minute, where do you get these things? I remember one episode I talked about, this custom-made machine that was kind of come from Korea. And I thought, when do you order this thing? You don't just go on Amazon.
Yeah.
And have it Amazon Prime and it's there in a couple of days. No, you have to think, a year in advance. And then if it's coming from Korea, is it actually coming from Korea? Are they putting it on a ship? Is it going through the Suez Canal? Or
you can pick it up at Long Beach.
How is it if it's going into Long Beach? Then
right.
Are they shipping it all the way across the country to Nova Scotia? Are they going through the Panama Canal? How are they getting it there? Or is it being manufactured someplace else? And then, of course, what do you do with it when you're finished?
That's a great question, yeah.
Where does it go? Take it back? All I'm saying is that these guys have this plan in place, and they're able to make these things happen. And a lot of fans have talked to me about how not only do they find the show interesting, just that they're hoping that they're going to find some treasure, but the way that they work it out together, how they figure out a plan and how to do things, and how everybody's got a job to do, is something that for a lot of people, it's a great lesson for children. It's like, okay, you've got something you want to do. Okay, let's figure out how to do it, as opposed to I just want to do it and just do it for me. No, you've got to do some work. We've got to invest. You've got to plan for this. You got to save a little bit, and then you've got these machines doing this crazy stuff. Who doesn't want to see a giant oscillating machine that's 10 feet wide? Going crazy on putting little dynamite charges around and blowing them up. I mean, it's fascinating stuff to watch all this equipment work. And Billy Gerhardt is amazing. The guy can drive anything. You put him in any kind of a device, and the guy knows how to work it. And he's incredibly delicate with it as well. It's like, Billy, can you go down another, half an inch? He's got like some giant hammer grab thing. And he's going, yeah, sure, no problem. And he does it. It's like, he's wiping a baby's butt or something. It's like so gentle.
Right. Yeah. It's a phenomenal show, I should say. Not an incredible show. It's been phenomenal for a while. And I've seen a number of episodes myself, and I'm intrigued by it all. But I always
let's hope they find something.
That's
what
I keep
thinking. A lot of very interesting things, a lot of clues, and you know, this last season when they went to Portugal, fascinating.
It's very interesting. But I always wonder what are they going to find now? What big significant thing will they find? It's always on my mind. And again, I'm surprised that show's gone on as long as it has. In a positive way.
When we did it, we thought, you know, maybe a
few
10
episodes. Yeah.
I mean, come on. Now we're in like 150 episodes into this. People are definitely invested. They feel like they're part of the Fellowship of the Dig.
Yeah, people are in
part of the team.
And of course, Robert, we are sort of coming to a close very soon here.
Okay.
I don't want to take too much of your time here, but you know, on other subjects like let's say the paranormal, where do you stand with that? Are you open minded to that sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't shut anything out. You know,
So in other words,
to everything doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, come on.
So in other words, you're saying that you're open to like narrate a ghost show.
Oh, heck yeah.
Definitely. You're in.
Are they paying me? Then I'm definitely open for it.
Then you're in. what about...
Yeah, no. As an actor, you're looking forward to the next challenge.
To the next gig, right.
The next gig, next challenge. You didn't even mention Red Notice that I was the opening narrator for, which was, you know, huge hit on Netflix with Dwayne Johnson and Gal Gadot and Ryan Reynolds. The director is Rawson Thurber. Has become friends, and he was a huge fan of Ancient Aliens. And so when he wrote the opening monologue, he said, "You're my guy. I wrote it with you in mind."
Love that.
Yeah.
That's always good to get work. And for those that don't know, you know, I do these freelance projects all the time, and sometimes you get a yes, sometimes you get a no, but you're just happy to get continuous work at times. And for those who've never narrated a book or tried, the book could be it's very hard. The book could be a maximum of, or a total of 4 hours, let's say, but that's not counting all the screw ups you've made and the re-recordings you have to do. It's not as glamorous as some people think that, you know, it's an easy job. You're just talking to a mic
Oh
my God.
First of all, how do you rehearse it?
Yeah, right.
What do you read the book out loud three or four times?
At least.
And it'll take
takes a while.
2 days to do. And then, of course, you have to be word perfect. And, you know, if your shirt makes a little bit of a noise, forget it. You got to go back. That's where you need a really good director. So, you know, narrating a book is really hard.
It's tough.
And the people that do it well, man, my hat is off to them. I've done a few books, but, man, it is tough.
It really is. And then, of course, you have in my position, you know, I've done maybe two or three, and sometimes you don't get paid. Sometimes people rip you off. And that's happened to me. That's the trouble of being a freelancer.
Yeah, there's that.
I'm sure you know about that. Yeah, it's happened.
Oh, yeah. They won it yesterday. So you bust your tail. And then, of course, you know, 4 months later, you're still waiting for that check.
Oh,
like, wait a minute. I thought you needed this so right away.
Yeah, you needed urgency. Yeah, you need it so urgent.
You can't cut me that check right away as well? No.
Yeah, that's the struggle with doing this, boys and girls. It's a constant
hustle.
Don't
try this at home.
I would not recommend it for anyone. You know, it's so shattering at times, as I mentioned to you here. But when you have success, it's fantastic, though.
Yeah, well, one of the things I think a key for an actor, first of all, is to not take it so seriously. Because a lot of actors that I know, you know, they think it's so important, you know, that they're solving the world's problems. You're really not. You're entertaining.
Yeah.
Your job is to have some fun doing this. So don't take yourself so seriously. And also, the difference between getting the gig and not getting the gig is thinner than a piece of paper. They just either pick you or they don't.
Right.
So if you get the gig, doesn't mean you're brilliant. And if you don't get the gig, doesn't mean you're crap. It just means you either got it or you didn't. Now, you need to be good. That helps. Certainly helps.
Right.
Especially in voiceovers. You got to put in the work. But at the same time, you got to have, we talked about this a little bit before, you have to have that thick skin and just know that rejection is the price you pay. And, you know, Bryan Cranston said he became successful when he started looking at the audition instead of as an audition, but as an opportunity to perform.
Yeah.
Took all the pressure off.
That's a good way to see
it. Hey, I just get to go and act for these people. Whether they hire me or not, doesn't matter. You know, I get to show my thing. I get to do a little performance today. That's fun. And then all of a sudden, he started working all the time.
Right. you got to take it as a practice run and just material yeah. that, you know, you could use later on in your portfolio.
Yeah.
That's really what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. And of course, going back to, you know, strange subjects here before we close it down as well. Mm-hmm. What about Bigfoot? Are you open to Bigfoot or not really?
You know, it's, I'm not shutting it down. We did an episode about Bigfoot on Ancient Aliens. And I have to be honest, I thought that was one of the weaker shows, that Bigfoot was some kind of a human hybrid experiment gone wrong, human alien hybrid gone wrong. But this, you know, the Yetis, Bigfoot, there's so much we don't know. There's so much that's unexplored. We're in a stage in life in human evolution where we are way ahead of who we are in our primitive selves. We're basically we should still be in caves, right? But now we're in jet airplanes, and we're, you know, dealing with the internet. So we think that all the information about everything is available to us within a nanosecond. There's a lot more we don't know than what we do know. We're just kind of scratching the surface a little bit. Even if I don't even know if we're scratching the surface. We're infants when it comes to what's really out there. And we know a lot, but we don't know everything, and nowhere near it. That's and part right. of the wonderful aspect of life for me is the not knowing.
I agree. Yes.
We're curious people that search for knowledge. And why do you think people have debates and arguments? Is because they don't know. They're trying to figure it out. And that's the challenge that human beings have. And fortunately, we've got brains. We're able to make those kind of choices and decisions and have those arguments. And we can look back and go, wow, I screwed up there. I was wrong, or I was right, whatever it might be. But it's the search for knowledge. It's the curiosity. That's what keeps us going. The exploration. I mean, how much of the ocean do we really know? We don't have
only a small
clue.
Portion.
Maybe
yeah.
we studied, you know, 1 or 2% of it. Usually, basically, just the surface. What's going on down deep? We haven't a clue.
Life is a mystery.
And isn't it wonderful that it is?
I agree. Everyone is seeking for all the answers. That's part of the red race. It's a curse and a blessing, some would say.
Yes, and as the door opens, you know, or as the door closes, more open.
Yeah.
As one question is answered, more are asked. That's what's interesting about life.
It really is. And Robert, once again, I do want to thank you for being a part of the program. It's been an honor and pleasure. I've been wanting to talk to you for multiple years now. I'm glad we finally got the chance to do that. And of course, Robert, if you feel like plugging anything you'd want or any upcoming projects you're involved with, now is the time to tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter. Also, I do cameos if you want like a little greeting, video greeting, birthday greeting, whatever. You can catch me on Cameo. And also I have this is very interesting. There's a site called Jemmy, J-E-M-I. And it's basically a, you know, kind of a store. So a lot of people wanted scripts from Ancient Aliens or Curse of Oak Island. And I used to bring those to conventions. But since we haven't had any conventions for the last couple of years,
right.
I decided to offer those to people that wanted to have one. And it's my personal script. It's the one that I actually had in front of me when I was reading whatever that show would be, either Ancient Aliens or Curse of Oak Island. And a lot of them have my little handwritten notes where if I don't know how to say something, I'll do that. Or we make little chicken scratches to change this or that. And I'll autograph it for you and send it out to you, and you can have a memento. So that's available. And I can't tell you what's coming up, but let's say that you will be hearing a lot from me.
Oh, nice. Very busy here in 2022.
Yeah. It's all
nice.
Good. It's all good.
Very good. Well, once again, Robert, I will talk to you again on the other side.
Absolutely. Pleasure.
And there he goes, boys and girls. That was Robert Clotworthy. He's the narrator for the History Channel series Ancient Aliens and, of course, The Curse of Oak Island. And he is also known for his role of Jim Raynor in the StarCraft video game series. If you guys enjoyed that one very much, thank you for pressing play, and we will be back soon with more live shows. And with that said, the world is a mysterious place, and life itself is a mystery. Until next time, good night, everybody.